And this last session is going to be a little bit more interactive. Well, maybe interactive. There's no presentation per se. It's mostly going to be a demo for EndNote. But hopefully you all got a copy of this literature search resources. And so, we're all scientists here, and one of the important things about science is that we never really do, we do things that are innovative, but our innovation is always based on the work of others. And so in that vein, it's always important that we give appropriate credit to the people who've done the preliminary work, who've done the initial experiments or established the system that we're studying, or other people who've contributed to our own ideas. And so I just had a student do a poster for this conference this week, and there were no references on them. I was like, well, did you come up with everything yourself? And so we eventually figured out that we needed to put some citations in there to give other people credit. And so the question is, how do we do that? How do you find new ideas that are worth working on? And when you're producing your own published work, how do you give others credit? And more and more in the biological and the biophysical and the biochemical sciences, there's more and more papers for us to read. There's more and more things for us to stay current on. And when we cite our own, when we write papers and cite the work of others, there's more and more papers that we need to cite. And so the question is, how do we keep a handle on this literature that we're trying to keep up with? And so, just as we've been talking about computers for the rest of this workshop, computers have been designed so that you can, or tools have been designed so that you can do literature management easier too. And so the first thing that I thought, we'll sort of do them in at the same time. But the paper that you have sort of discusses the online databases. And so when you're keeping track of what papers are being published in my field, it's always good to know where to go online. And 30 years ago, probably before I was born, people would spend most of their time, and they would have paper or print journal subscriptions. They would go through those journal subscriptions and maintain a library of journal articles that they wanted to use. But really, gone are those days, and gone are the days really where you would even go to the library to do this. Nowadays, it's much more convenient to use one of these online literature databases and arrange a search so that you can do find relevant articles and then look them up and screen them as you would need to. And so today, or this module is designed to sort of give you an idea of where you would find that stuff, how you might make reference management a little bit easier, and then how you could incorporate some of those citations once you have a library of references that you've gone over and read, how you could incorporate those into a publication. Okay, and so we're going to be using a program here. Now, this is the only program I guess PyMOL's technically not free if you follow all the rules. But this is the only program that we're talking about that's not technically free. But as MSU students or anybody affiliated with MSU can purchase a copy of EndNote from the library for $50. And that's probably the best investment that you guys can make, whether you're undergraduates, whether you're graduate students. If you're a postdoc and you don't have EndNote on your computer, it's a good investment there too. EndNote normally costs $300, $350 for a new copy, and keeping them updated, there's a new version every couple of years, that's usually another $100, $150. Whereas here, if you're an MSU student, you basically pay $50, and every time there's an update, you just go to the library and you get another CD with the update on it. So it's really quite a good deal if you do it. And I strongly encourage all of my own graduate students to do it because it's such a good deal. And when we write papers, I say, look, if you don't have this, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to work with you, because it's, you know, I'm not going to try to manage my references using another type of software. And so EndNote, we're not going to go over the installation. It's very simple to install. You just run the installer. It generally assumes that you have Microsoft Office, and it's indeed it works best with Microsoft Office. And so, you know, for 90% of what we're going to be doing here today, we'll be assuming that you're using Microsoft Word and that you'll be running EndNote. But again, as MSU students, you know, all of us have access to the home use program, where you can basically download Office for $10. And so again, when it's that cheap, there's really no excuse not to use it. And indeed, most of the academic community, you know, the physical fields, the computer science fields, they'll use programs like Tech and BibTeX and other types of you know, open source programs to do their citations. But in the biological, the chemical community, it's mostly using Microsoft Word, and that's what the journal articles want to see, or the journals want to see. And so let's take a quick look here at EndNote to start. It's no longer on my application bar, but okay, so generally when you start EndNote, you're going to get a very bland-looking window. And what EndNote works with, like if Microsoft Word deals with Word document files or you know, some kind of printed page, the object that EndNote operates on is literature libraries. Okay, and so EndNote, a typical EndNote document or EndNote object, is going to be a collection of references or collection of journal articles that you've saved. Okay, so when you start it up for the first time, it probably gives you a little bit more than this, but when I go here to File New, you're going to see up here it says New Reference Library. Okay, and so it's asking me, you know, it's assuming I want to create a new library of journal references. And so for the purposes of this workshop, we're just going to go ahead and make one. I'll put on my desktop. And some people have different strategies for this. So let's just make a generic library. And then I'll show you a little bit about what I do and how I manage my EndNote libraries. So when you make an EndNote library, you have a window. You can see the extension is ENL for EndNote Library. And if you look here, there's a section. Now, we don't have any references in here yet, but there's a big white section where your references would appear. You have some search functionality up here at the top. So I can search based on author, year, so general things that you might expect to search for in a reference managing system. There's ways to do online searches, and so you can go in and you can search PubMed. So if I want to search PubMed, now I don't have a whole lot of papers, but if I wanted to search PubMed for me, I could search PubMed for me. Okay, and so there it would bring up all of the papers that I've written or worked on. And so you can see now there's this area here is full of publications, you know, that keeps an author list. And again, here I was searching on PubMed. Now we'll talk about specific libraries in a bit. But you can see that there's a reasonable organization to how this EndNote library is maintained. Okay, and so so there's sort of the overview of what EndNote, you know, generally looks like. But probably as a new graduate student or as a new undergraduate or somebody who's just starting out on a research project, you're probably going to want to start a new library, and you probably want that library to stay with you for a long time. Okay, so here I've just made a new library that I've called Generic Library, but I also have, if I go here into my documents, I should have an EndNote. So I have this guy called Fitzky Library. And so here you can see, I mean, this is a much more sophisticated library. It contains, I'm not going to try to use my hand to reach up there. So it contains a total of about 700 references. You can look at those references here when you have all references selected. And so you can see they range in, lots of different types of journals, lots of different authors. You can sort based on the year. So my earliest one is this Emil Fischer, which is, I forget where I cited that, but clearly I don't speak German, so this was not a paper that I actually read in much detail. But but you can see when you double-click on a reference, okay, so let's go back to this Solomon paper, which I have read. So Solomon was a big NMR guy. He developed the theory of relaxation in many different spin systems. So if I click on his 1955 relaxation processes paper, you can see, this shows up. It's a window. And looking at that, I have the ability to rate the title. I have the ability to look at the author list. The title of the journal article is here, but there's all sorts of different types of fields, including a link, like if I can link back to the original publication page, that are associated with this one particular reference. Okay, and so as I'm building up a library, you can think of a library as a list of references, and one reference contains all of these different types of fields that can be filled out. Okay, and so we'll go in here, and I won't work on this, but I won't work on my original library, but you can see that there's all sorts of references, and it can handle, this is the Metropolis Monte Carlo paper, where they do simulations of different systems using random numbers. You can see there's a whole bunch of authors here, so there's five authors, including Edward Teller, who worked on the atomic bomb. There's the title. Again, it keeps a list of the volume, the issue. Now, not every single one of these things. I mean, for any of you who've read a journal article, you know that not every single journal requires you to put the publisher. In fact, I can't think of any journal that requires you to put the publisher of a paper. But sometimes it's nice to have. In particular, for really old articles where the publisher no longer exists, you can sort of say, oh yeah, I look at that publisher, I know that they no longer exist, so I'm not going to try to find this or track it down. And sometimes you want to rate a paper as really good or really bad. Probably one star, if it's a really bad paper, it's probably not going to make it into your library. And so probably when you adjust your expectations for one star versus five stars, you should probably be thinking that one star is maybe tangentially relevant to your research, whereas five stars is really, really super important, something that your foundations of your own research project are based on. And so you can go, it doesn't have like the Netflix, like loved it and hated it. It just has the different stars that you can use. And you could use whatever rating system that you want. Up here at the top, right now it's selected for journal article, but you can go and click on that drop down, and there's all sorts of other types of options here. I've never entered an ancient text, but I suspect if you're an archaeologist, you might have an ancient text or two. I've similarly never done a bill. And so most of the time, I'll be citing journal articles. There's an entry in here for book. And so you can see if I change it to book, fundamentally nothing. I mean, it still has the same kinds of fields. It's just that instead of journal year or journal title, it might have, it just has the title of the book. Okay, and so a lot of times what this is just telling you is it's giving you different types of contexts Whereas if a title of a journal article is going to be the title of the article itself, the title of the book is going to be the title of the book. But you'll see that we could that how EndNote references, or how when EndNote generates a bibliography, the bibliography entry is going to be different whether it's a book versus a journal article. And that's exceptionally useful to have, because then you can just go in and make your journal, your library in EndNote, and EndNote will do all the hard work for you in generating the bibliography later on. And so it doesn't really make that much of a difference at this phase when I'm just entering the information. But later on when I'm generating the bibliography, a journal article entry is going to look way different than a book. Okay. So now how do you get information in here? So one way is to do just like I said. So there's a couple of different online libraries that you can search. We'll talk about them later on in specifics. But PubMed, as we've already looked at for the PubMed is part of Entrée, so it's part of the NCBI database system. PubMed is a really convenient way to search for things. And you can go in here and search just by author, or you could add additional fields. And you can see there's ways to search for all of the stuff. And so if I'm particularly looking for an article on... Let's say retroviral protease. Now, I never wrote any articles on that. But I can go in here, hit enter, or hit search. And you're going to see that it comes up with 53 references. It's going to give me the option to import all of them, or I could just select a random number of them. Now, at this point, you don't know what articles it found, right? So some of them might be worthwhile, some of them might not be. Generally, if you go this approach and you're using this online search box, probably what you're going to do is go through that list of 53 and delete the ones that you don't want. And so that's generally what happens. But depending on what you type in here, like if you type Smith up here in the author, it's going to load 196,000 different articles. And so you probably don't want to go through those individually, and you probably need to refine your search and add some more more filters on it. Okay, so but let's say that we want to go in here and we want to make a new reference. So one way to do that would be to go here. Now, if I go File New, it's going to make a new library, so I don't want to do that. If I go File New Reference, again, you can see now it's given me the blank reference. It defaults to journal article, which is 9 times out of 10 what you're going to do. And so if you're doing a new reference and you're generating it manually, a lot of times I'll have to do this for like a book. Because I can go online and I can download journal information from the various publishers, but if I have a book in my hand and I'm using that book, it's often the case that there's no place where I can go down and download the citation information. So that's one of the nice things about using the PubMed search, is it fills all this information for you. But if you have a book, and so let's assume I'm doing a book. Okay, anybody have a book? I mean, any kind of book? It doesn't have, it can be fiction. Is anybody just carrying a book in their bag? Oh, there you go. So let's use this. Okay, so we're going to do this. I'm not sure what I would be citing that I'd be talking about the CLEP history of the United States, but maybe there's some really important historical detail that I haven't been able to find anywhere else. But it's in here, so I can cite it. So let's see. And let's just go in and fill this out. Now the author, is there an author? There has to be an author. This is going to be hard, right? I mean, if you were just doing a regular book for a... Okay, so it looks like there's a group of authors called... So this might be good to do... Staff of Research and Education Association. Okay, so there is no list of authors. Normally, I could go in here and put, you know, Robertson, or let's just do Roberts, G.D., and then I would put a different author on each line. And you can see it defaults, like, you know, here's Eric Farquhar. And so, and there's Pat Fleming. You know, there is some field completion. And if you look at this, one of those is in red, and one of those is in black. And so the red one is telling you that author entry, and this works for lots of other fields as well, but that particular author entry is unique to this particular reference. Okay, it means that there is no other instance of Robert's GD in my library. And so sometimes that's useful, because if I know that I've worked with a guy named George Roberts, maybe that means I have his middle initial wrong. Or maybe his first initial is, E. George Roberts, or something like that. So that red, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad, but it is telling you that, hey, this is a unique, or this is a new entry. And so maybe if you think that you already have a library entry with that guy's name in it, or that woman's name in it, it could be Geraldine, you should probably look it up and double check the spelling. Whereas Eric Farquhar is another author that I've published with, and so he already has an entry in here, and so it shows up in black.
Okay, but then if we're really trying to do this, what we would probably do is we would type staff of research and education association. And then I'd have to put a comma at the end of that. Anybody want to guess why?
Okay. Well, the reason I would want to put a comma there is because, remember, eventually I'm going to be making a bibliography with this, right? And so I want to make sure that when I make my bibliography, it's going to put, Roberts, G.D., Farquhar, E.R., and this. And so I want to make sure that I tell it, hey, this isn't like a real author's name. You shouldn't be trying to figure out last name, first name here. By putting a comma, you're basically saying that, hey, that author is that's all you have for that author. And so it's going to look here and it's going to say, oh, there are no first initials. And it's just going to put the staff of the Research and Education Association as the author. So that's a useful trick to know. So in that sense, I guess it's good that we're using this. Because again, the first time that you do this, you're like, how on earth do I put this author in? And then EndNote would like reference it as Education Association, comma, Staff of Research and Education. And that would be bad. And you'd be frustrated. So, again, note that they're a different author on each line. The year, that should be easy. So, again, we always use the latest publication year, which in this case is 2004. Apparently, the history of the United States hasn't changed much since, well, early colonization to 1877 hasn't changed much since 2004, so I guess that's good. The title would be History of the United States 1. And it would be in a series called The Best Test Preparation for the CLEP. Now, another thing to look at is I'm putting in this as title case, right? So I'm lowercasing my prepositions and my articles. Remember, that's things like for, the, and of. It's one of the things I forget is what my basic high school grammar was, because you never think about it. Until you have to teach somebody that doesn't speak English well, and it's like, well, what is that word? Oh, that's an article. So it's always good to know your grammar. And so I'm putting capitalizations here. Different publishers or different journals might want you to have different types of capitalization styles. So, like, I know some ACS journals want you to start with a capitalization and use a sentence case. Okay, so depending on how you have that set up, you actually might need to go back into your EndNote library and tweak things so that it gives you the right bibliographic results. There are some tools, and I don't think we'll have time to go into this, but you can go in and hit, like, you know, recapitalize my titles in sentence case. And so you can tell EndNote to do that when you generate the bibliography. But in this particular case, you know, it wouldn't, it would just be dumb, right? It would capitalize history and lowercase everything else, not recognizing that the United States is a proper noun and I is a Roman numeral and would need to be capitalized. And so sometimes you can get away with the EndNote sort of automatic dummy tricks, but a lot of times I find that, you know, I have to go in and do some tweaks on it to get it to be correct relative to what the journal wants. And so in general, like, again, thinking about library management, I usually have my master library that I call Fiske EndNote Library. And then if I'm working on a paper with a student, again, I want to pass 698 references back and forth to them via email. So I'll make a subset of that library that's specific to that journal article. And then if I need to make journal article specific tweaks to my titles or my authors or something like that, then I just, you work on the subset, and then I don't have to be worrying about, you know, damaging or contaminating my master library with some specific or some oddball journal article's requirements. Okay, and so place published. Again, if you have the book in hand, this is usually pretty easy. This looks like it's Piscataway, New Jersey. And again, Piscataway is not like a big city like New York or London, and so you have to put the state. Publisher is Research and Education Association, maybe? Yeah, it looks like it. And then that's pretty much it. The rest of it you can probably just ignore, because again, no journal article is going to really ask you for the ISBN number. So in that sense, we've done it. If I close this, it's going to ask me to save it. Or not, because I told it not to. And oh, it's at the bottom. Oh, there we go. Yep. So there we go. And now we have a new entry in our EndNote library. Okay, and so again, for books, oftentimes you have to enter the books manually. But, you know, part of the things on this literature resources, and so you have several different literature databases. For biochemistry and biophysics, the main one that we're using is PubMed. And so let's take a quick look here. So now we've sort of introduced you to the concept of EndNote and how it can store literature. I guess we didn't really talk about making new groups or references, but you can create a new group. And so if I want to link all of, you know, for example, let's say history publications. So I can go in here and make a new group, and I'll drag this guy in. And so now I can sort of organize my library topically. And so that can be very useful if you have multiple different types of research projects or even multiple different aspects of your own research project. Like, you're looking at, you know, why is this medically relevant? You can group all those together. You know, methods that you use, you can group all those together. And so having groups can be very useful. You can create as many groups as you want. So here's a random group. And again, a single article can exist in more than one group. And if you ever want to go back to your all references, you can just select and bring them into the group that you want to go into. So you can organize your EndNote references, and I strongly recommend that you do,
You can see I'm not so good at it. Again, out of my about 700 references, almost 460 of them are unfiled. Fortunately, I have students with good memories, and if we need to pass something back and forth, they can tell me, oh yeah, that paper from 2004. But now let's suppose you're doing some real research, and you want to go out to the real world and find some papers. Probably for biochemical research, the first place that you're going to look is a place called PubMed. You can access PubMed through that NCBI jQuery site that we looked at, 2 days ago. But it's easier just to go to PubMed.org, and it'll redirect you to the official NCBI website. But now you can go in here, and this just gives you a search box. So think of this as Google for journal articles. Because this is linked to lots of different journals, this is going to have a broader search base than just using Google alone. Okay, so let's look for papers on a project that I had been working on. So let's just search for HIV integrase. And let's compare and contrast the results from Google and PubMed. Okay, so Google does give you some scholarly articles here. And so if you click on scholarly articles, you'll be taken into Google Scholar, which is another sort of online database of papers. But if you look here, these are giving you articles in, maybe not this one. But it's giving you articles in reputable journal publications like, New Microbiology. Bioorganic Medicinal Chemistry. So you're seeing about 3,000 or so articles out of different journal publications. If you go to Google, you'll get more, but it's often ranked differently. So PubMed is ranked by date, so it gives you the newest articles first by default. Google, as most Google searches, it gives you the articles that are the most reputable first. And so... Here's an article by one of my old collaborators, Bob Craigie. But this really isn't, it's not super new. It's 1999, I think, 2001. So it isn't a reputable journal. It's Journal of Biological Chemistry. And it gives you, I think I've even used some of his figures in talks that I've given. So this is a good article to find. But again, it's not super new. Google and PubMed both give you access to the literature, but I typically trust PubMed first because it's indexed directly to journals, whereas Google is sort of going on its crawling, uses the same algorithm that it uses to search for anything else. And so when it searches, your Facebook page, it's also searching, the Journal of Biological Chemistry and other types of journals with an online web presence. I think it's better to start with PubMed. PubMed has much easier ways to search for authors. Suppose I want to search for everything that Bob Craigie has published. So again, these are the same shortcuts that were in the slides from your first day when we talked about searching protein databases. And so if I search for, I guess I need to do Craigie R. So notice the underscore instead of the space. Okay, now he's obviously published a lot more than me. But you can see now it searches, and so here his most recent paper was The Road to HIV Integrase Inhibitors, The Case for Supporting Basic Research. That's a good article because oftentimes you hear a lot of people that, if you're not actually developing drugs, you're just doing basic research, you're not contributing to anything. And that's an opinion that we have to battle at the NIH an awful lot. So you can see, and it has basically every paper that he's ever published. You can go in, you can, you know, suppose I only want to look at the papers that he published from 1990 to 2000. So I would go and 1990:2000. And DP is date of publication. Okay, and so sometimes your advisor will go to you and say, hey, look up this paper by so-and-so. I think it was published in, you know, 2003, but it could have been, you know, 2004 or 2002. And so here you can have a really easy way to look for papers published by a specific person or published within a specific date range. Okay, and so using an online database like this can be very useful in helping you to identify papers that are important for your field. And so you don't need to have the author. You can go in, and again, if I just want to search HIV integrase papers, again, this sort of gives me the picture of HIV integrase during the decade of the 90s. Okay, and so if you know that your research is building off of stuff, you don't want to cite things exclusively from the 90s, but you can sort of use this to get yourself a historical perspective. Okay, so PubMed is sort of your first go-to. We've talked about Google Scholar, which is on the second page. There's a couple of other ones here. So Scopus is another paper or another database that's extremely useful. It's a subscription service. And so, you know, we can access it because we're here at Mississippi State. If you were to go home to your dorm or to your apartment, you wouldn't be able to, well, if you're in your dorm and you're on campus, you'd be able to access it. But if you were in your apartment, you probably wouldn't be able to access it because you're accessing it through some third-party internet provider. But this detects that I'm here at Mississippi State, and so I can do the same kinds of things here. So I can search for HIV integrase. And what's useful about Scopus, and so Scopus is my second line, where if I'm looking for a journal article, I'll probably go to PubMed first, Scopus second. Scopus is nice because it searches a broader range. So PubMed is exclusively biomedical type research. And so some of the papers that I've published, like on chemistry topics, don't actually show up in PubMed because they're thinking, well, nanoparticles, who cares about that? And so Scopus will index a broader array of libraries or journals. And so it'll pick up things from the physics field or the computer science field or you know, the sociology field.
The other really nice thing about Scopus is that you can search and you can do things like sort by the number of articles that cited a particular article. And so if you're just getting started in a field and you don't really have the context, like, who are the big players in this field? Who are writing the papers that lots of other people are citing? You know, the ability to sort by or search articles that people have cited is extremely useful. And so this article has been cited 852 times. It's a science paper. That's also probably telling you that it's an important paper. And you can look at it. You can open up the original article. And, you know, again, it has information here. It keeps a list of all of the articles that this thing cites. But then you can also go and look at the over here we're cited by. You can search and you can see, okay, what articles are citing this? Okay, so think of yourself again in the position where you're starting out, you don't know a whole lot. You find some of the really important articles, and then you say, okay, well, who cited this? You can go through and sort of build up a sort of history of what are the most important papers that people are citing and what kinds of papers are citing this paper. Okay, so it's often very useful if you can look at a particular paper and say, oh, this was cited, you know, 16 times, and every single time was a journal in Nature or something that was published in PNAS. So it can tell you, oh, this is an important paper, and maybe I should read some of the other papers that cited it too. And so in this way, you know, oftentimes it's easy to work back in time. Like if you start with an article that was published in 2013, you can look at its reference list and go back and continue to go back and work your way back. But Scopus gives you the ability to work your way forward by starting with a very important paper and seeing who's publishing or who's referencing that paper in their work. Okay, and because of that, it's extremely useful. It does have its own sort of system. So if you want to, you know, search by author names and let's go back here. So you do have, it's not quite as convenient. You can go in, but you can search authors. So if I want to search, you know, anything that Craigie published on Integrase. Okay, and so here it's still sorting by cited by. His structure or his work, this was actually a David Davies paper, but his work to purify the integrase domain of HIV, you can see was cited 600 or almost 600 times. And so you can look at a particular author's contribution and see what their, you know, how much clout they have in the field. And so Craigie is obviously a huge guy. There are certainly people who have published more papers by him, or more papers than him. We have a guy in chemistry who published like 800 papers, but of his 800 papers, I'm sure they weren't averaging 190, 200 citations. So this is a case for, you know, publishing the best work that you possibly can and getting it out there, and hopefully lots of people will like it. And to be, you know, Craigie with his 114 publications is a way more impactful scientist than, you know, the guy in our department with, well, he's retired now, but he has, you know, the guy in our department with like 800 pubs. So numbers are good, but they can also be used to mislead at times. Okay, so now, I mean, and SciFinder, again, this is mostly a chemical thing, and so I know we have some people who aren't chemists in here, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time. And Web of Knowledge is similar to Scopus in that you can look for journals that cite other articles or how many times a particular article has been cited. My first year we subscribed to Web of Science, but we no longer do. And so that's sort of in here just as a history. And you might go to another university where they have Web of Science, and so you can use it there. But I think our libraries, and the problem is that you know, journal subscriptions and access to services like Scopus, I mean, generally run in the hundreds of thousands of dollars per year. And so looking at, you know, if a university is tight, and unfortunately money is never really, really loose around here at Mississippi State, they might have to make a choice. And so Mississippi State made the choice to go with Scopus rather than Web of Science. But let's suppose you've done some searching and you found a paper. So let's look here at Fred Dita's crystal structure. You want to get this paper into EndNote. Okay, and that's generally the next step. So you've read this paper or you've read the abstract. It looks interesting. You think, oh yeah, I should probably add that to my library. There's a couple of ways to go here. So most journals or most of these databases will have a way to export. And so if you click on this export button, one of the things it's going to give you is the RIS format, which it says can be imported into EndNote. And so let's do that from here. So let's hit export. I want the citation and the abstract. Okay, so I want to import this citation, the particular difference or the information that this guy that this record contains. I also want to import the abstract because, again, in EndNote, I can search by abstract. And so I can search my library, and if the abstract's in there, that makes it more useful. There's other options here, like you can specify its own reference list to be imported as well. That just gets very, then your reference list gets really crazy.
And personally, for me, I like my EndNote library to only contain papers that I've read or that I'm familiar enough that I'm comfortable to cite them. And so we're just going to do abstract and citation. Hit export. It's going to give you a thing. Now, if you hit here, open with ResearchSoft Direct Export Helper, you see that comes up right in EndNote. And so now EndNote has imported that. And so FDITA, all the authors are in here. The crystal structure page, the title is in here. All the information, including the abstract, is now loaded into my EndNote library. Now, for comparison, because I think it's sometimes good to do a direct comparison and just show you how these things can differ, let's load the same paper up here. So, DITA, F, and Davies, DR. And I think that was the right one. Yeah, polynucleotidyl transferases. Yep. Save that. Now in EndNote, we can also go here to send to, and we can send it to the citation management, create the file. Doesn't give you as many options, but when you create the file, it does say open with, and it gives you the same thing. So let's take a look here and see how it opens. Okay, and let's just go up, and I want to bring one more in here because there's a definite way to compare. Okay, and so we can go here to the full text as well. And so and similarly, oh man, that stinks. You see that a lot here at Mississippi State. Let's just see if we can view it at publisher. Because I don't really need the full text. I can demonstrate the full text. Yeah. So this is on JSTOR. But here again, you can go to the article itself, or you can go to the publisher itself, and you can download the citation there. And so if we export the citation, we'll do EndNote again, and we'll open. Okay. Now, we'll have to search for DITA. Okay, so let's take a look. Now, even from here, you can start to see that there are differences, right? So this is the third one I got from the actual journal. I think that's where I got it from. And this first one, I think, was the original. Nah, maybe that first one is from the journal, because that would make more sense. Yeah. We can sort these. So you can see they're given an index number up here at the top. So 18 is the first one I downloaded, 19 is the second, and the third one is from the journal article itself. Okay, so let's take a quick look here. So one thing to notice right away is that when I downloaded the reference from PubMed and from Scopus, it just gives me the author's initials. If I want the full name, generally I have to go to the journal article itself. Okay, and you know, as a purist, I generally do want the full name. Because I can always take my full name, like I can always take Fred DITA and convert that into DITA F. But there's no way I can go from DITA F and ever figure out, you know, is that Fred, is that Francis, is that Frank? So in that sense, looking at the journal article or the article webpage itself is usually somewhat better. If you look here under Publisher, you can see that you're given that information. Whereas the previous two, I don't believe it has Publisher. The page numbers, again, PubMed, I would say, is acceptable, 1981 to 1986. This one is format specific, right? So if a journal article wants you, or a journal wants you to include all the full pages of the article, you're going to be able to do it with this, but you're going to have to go back in and manually type in the full pages with this. Okay? So usually the information that you get from the article website itself is often a better source. You know, in particular, if you're looking at like a European journal where people have like really fancy letters and characters in their last name, oftentimes that information will be stored on the journal article website, but when sites like PubMed or Scopus read it off, they're not getting the umlauts or the accents over the people's names. And so, you know, hopefully the point of this comparison makes it clear that generally you want to go to the journal source itself. I mean, if you're doing like 100 articles at a time, it's probably fine to use PubMed. But keep in mind that you might need to make some tweaks later on if a journal has a specific requirement for somebody's name. And, you know, think about it if it were you. I mean, if you had like, you know, if you were Bertrand Garcia Moreno and you had an accent over the I in Garcia, you know, it is a misspelling if you don't spell it with the accent. And so I figure it's a good idea to try to get as much of that information. I mean, not that people are maliciously trying to misspell their name, but as a sign of respect for other people in the scientific field, I think it's always a good idea to try to get as much information and get it correctly as possible. So my recommendation is, even though Scopus and SciFinder can both let you use their utilities, it's always a good idea to go and see if you can view it at the publisher, or oftentimes in PubMed, when you click that full text link, it'll actually take you to the publisher's website, and you can download the citation from there. Okay, questions? So the last thing I want to cover here is, suppose now you've done your work. Well, I guess we can also cover, yeah, we can cover this a little bit about EndNote 2. So pretend I did have access to this PDF. And so suppose this, here we go. Here's a paper. Now this obviously isn't Fred's paper, but it's a paper. And so I've, let me go over here and bring that over. So here's a paper on water suppression, but let's pretend that it was the crystal structure. So there's the water suppression paper. You can go in, and you can do it a couple of ways. But I can go in and drag this paper into my EndNote library. And you can see now my EndNote library has an attachment. And if I double-click that file, I can go up here, and that PDF file is now stored within EndNote. So it's stored within my EndNote library. Again, so EndNote not only is a way of keeping track of references, and you can, but it's also a way of keeping track of PDFs that you might download that are associated with that journal. And if there's other types of things like a supporting Excel spreadsheet or some images that the author sent you directly, you can also link those in. Now, one thing that's important to remember, though, is that EndNote doesn't store this in the same way. So here's my generic library. So that's the EndNote library. But when I make my generic library, it also creates this data directory. And the data directory is what's going to store the PDF files and any kind of attachments that you have. The ENL file is going to store the bibliographic information. And the ENL file, you can email back and forth. So if your advisor wants to say, hey, send me the references you found on this topic, you can always send the ENL file back and forth over email. But you probably don't want to send him every single PDF. Let's just do an experiment here. So I'm going to rename this blah, blah. Okay, and so now I'm going to open up my EndNote library again. And it's not going to be able to find the data directory. And so it's going to bring up this message that says, hey, I don't see the data folder. What that means is that all of the attachments, the PDF files, things that you've put in the library, you're not going to be able to access those. But if I click OK, it's still going to let me access the bibliographic information. And so if you're working on a paper or something with your advisor, just pass back the ENL file. That's all that you need to generate the bibliographic or the bibliography. The data stuff is useful for you, and you can always transfer that with a thumb drive, but if you have 1,000 PDFs, it's going to get pretty big. And so the ENL file is always going to be relatively small. In this case, the ENL file is less than 50K. So, okay. So now let's suppose you've made your library and you want to start thinking about making a journal or writing an article yourself. And so you'll open up Word because Word is what everybody uses. Well, it's what I use. A lot of people use Word. And a lot of the times, personally for me, I don't really like to be encumbered by the reference entry process. And so I will just write something like, this is an important statement, and then I'll put ref. And then I'll do this is another important statement that also needs a citation, ref. This is an alternate referencing style. Okay, so I've put in two different types of referencing styles. One where I have the period and then the reference. One where I have the reference before the period. So this is going to be the place where you might have Jones 1997. This is going to be more suited if your journal is you want a superscript with a number. Okay, lots of ACS journals do this, and so this is what I'm mostly used to. But a journal like Protein Science, at least up until recently, would have, FITSKI 2001. And so some of this, yes, EndNote can save you a lot of time, but it's not perfect, right? There's no way to immediately switch back and forth between, references before the period versus references after the period. So you have to have a little bit of an idea what you're writing for when you start. But again, oftentimes I'll just put in this parenthetical ref, and then I'll say I'm going to insert a reference there later. And that way I can get my paragraph or my page or my section written without having to constantly switch back and forth between EndNote and Word. But let's say I've gotten to that point, and now I want to start dragging in references. So there's a couple ways to do this. When you install EndNote, you'll see that there's a new EndNote tab up here. And if I have this reference selected in EndNote, and I go to EndNote, there's an option here to insert citation. So I can do that. It brings up this window. And I guess it defaults to, that's weird. So I can insert a citation and say that I want to search for Fred. So I'll search for Dita. And so I can select any of these ones. Now they're all the same. I'll hit insert. And you can see, if I get rid of the ref, it now inserts the thing and starts building the bibliography. Okay, and you can see it's built the bibliography based on the particular style I've chosen, which is what I use for NIH grants. And so it's a superscript style, but it includes, where applicable, it includes the appropriate PubMed Central IDs, which is kind of a requirement now for the more recent articles. I can go here, and as another example, I can go in and I can drag from EndNote into Word. And so that's oftentimes how I do it. So I'll drag it in. You can see it converts it to a reference. And then let's just, for example, look at a third example where I go before the period. Okay, and so here you can see it's three before the period. Now this would not be correct, but we'll show how it looks for other types of referencing styles. But, you know, it's very simple. And if I do some things like cut and paste, you can see it renumbers things automatically. So it's very, very useful. Now, I've shown you EndNote in interactive mode, where it's actually updating the references as we speak. Oftentimes, I will convert this to unformatted citations when I'm just working in my mind. You can see that gets rid of all the numbering. It gets rid of the bibliography. And instead, what I'm looking at are these little braces. And this is a little EndNote code to show what reference I'm referencing at that, or I'm trying to cite at that particular point. And so oftentimes I just use the unformatted citations, and then that way it's not trying to do any, you know, conversion while I'm typing. Because it, you know, as well as EndNote works, if you have a 50-page document, like your PhD thesis, it's going to be slow if it's trying to do all this updating in real time. And so I find it's just as easy to go and convert to unformatted citations. And then at the end of the time, when I'm done, I can go and hit update citations and bibliography, and it converts it all back. The other nice thing about unformatted citations is that I can send this. So if I'm working with one of my students, I can send the unformatted citations to my students. They don't even need to have an EndNote library. They can correct spelling errors and things like that, send it back to me, and then if I have the EndNote library, I just hit update and it's done. And so it makes it simpler, even simpler than transporting back just the ENL file. You can just transport the Word, and these little things, you know, these little curly braces can go in there. Now the one exception is oftentimes if you have multiple citations, you can just separate them via semicolon. So if I have three citations here, you know, it's going to default and put them all together with separate curly braces. But strictly speaking, they should be separated with a semicolon. And then we'll show you what happens here when you do that. Okay, so if I update them now you can see it's given me the 2, 3. I thought there were three there. Oh, well, I cited the one twice. So that's no good. Okay, so it is smart enough to do some checking and error correction. And then another nice thing about having them in unformatted citations is that I can set up a find and replace. So if I want to convert everything so I have this one here where I've put the referencing before the period. Okay, so I can go in here and I can do a replace, and I can find every instance of curly brace period and replace it with just a curly brace. Okay, and then I can find every instance of left curly brace and replace it with a period left curly brace. Let's hit replace all. Okay, so it's not perfect. I mean, the ones that already had periods now have two. You could do a find and replace on that and eliminate any two periods that you find. But you can see by working in the unformatted citations, you can actually switch back and forth somewhat easily to whether you're going to go with author year before the period or a number after the period. And so here I can go in, and if I just hit update, now it makes it, it all looks nice. Okay. Now, EndNote also has the ability to do multiple styles. So if I switch here to condensed named citations, you can see now, again, it's after the period, so it's, I need to do some switching. But you can see now it's switched to something where I have the list of citations. And so EndNote has a whole bunch of styles. We don't have time to go through editing styles and how to make new styles for a particular article. But oftentimes you can go to your style list, and if you're trying to publish something in, you know, Nature, or you know what we normally publish in, which are third-tier ACS journals, you can go and you can often find that journal, and you can then look and it'll have the styles automatically entered for you. And then oftentimes then, if you go into EndNote, you know, you can go in here and you know, edit your output styles, going into the style manager. And so you can go and edit them. And there's all sorts of options in here for how to format the bibliography, how to format citations. You can explore that, but we don't have time to go through that kind of stuff exhaustively now. And then the final thing that you want to do is, if you look here, when I click my citations, you can see that they turn gray. And specifically when I click here at my end, you know, it also turns gray. And what that means is that there's some kind of underlying Microsoft Word code or macro language that's being interpreted here. Okay, and again, when you send this to a collaborator who doesn't have EndNote or doesn't have your library, if you send it to them like this, they might have trouble opening it up and reading everything. And so the final thing that you need to be aware of is that you can convert this to plain text. We can save it. I guess it wants it to save. So let's just save it as an old document. And generally, you'll be like if you're working on a journal article, you'll have several copies saved, I'm sure. Desktop. There you go. This is an important document. Okay, so now let's convert it to plain text. Oh, that's not what I wanted to do. Okay. And what it does is it doesn't touch your original document with all of your EndNote references. But it gives you a copy, and now that copy contains all of your references as if you had just typed them into Word directly. Okay, so this one you can send to your mother, you can send it to your advisor, you can send it to anybody who would want to read it and might not have a copy of EndNote with your EndNote library, and they'll be able to see, oh, okay, that's what he's typing. Okay, and so this is generally what you get, what you submit to journals if they want the original Word document. Because again, this has all of the information, but it doesn't have any of that underlying EndNote stuff to complicate the Word document. It's just the text. And you can edit it here, but you know, now if I move this or if I delete this reference, you know, it's not going to necessarily recognize that reference is gone, and it won't take it out of my final thing. But you know, this is the format that the library is going to require you to submit if you submit your dissertation, that journal articles are going to require you to submit if they require a Word document. So it's good to know about converting it to plain text, because it's sort of the useful finishing tool. Okay, questions? Yeah, Olivia. So Zotero has, now I haven't used Zotero in about a year and a half, so they might have come up with some new things. Zotero is nice because it gives you a little button right in your Firefox or your Chrome window, that if you're looking at a journal, you click that button and it loads it right into your library. And so as far as a journal management system, I think they're comparable. And Zotero can actually be convenient
in the sense that you can sync it to an online database, and that if you're using your web browser at home, it can access the same list of citations that you have, you know, here at school or at work or whatever. EndNote can do that if you sign up for like their online service, and that's included with the purchase of the software, but it's not quite as integrated as Zotero. I mean, Zotero, you just click that button and it loads it. But when I had tried to use Zotero, the integration with Microsoft Word just wasn't there at all. So EndNote has fairly good journal management or article management system, but then the place where I think it really shines is the bibliographic stuff. And so maybe Zotero's gotten better. I mean, I know it's more of an open source, so it changes more frequently. But at least when I was trying to use Zotero to integrate with Microsoft Word and generate my bibliographies, it wasn't at the same level of polish. But Zotero has the advantage that it's free. Now, free versus $50 here at Mississippi State, I don't know, I think the $50 is a steal. But you know, if you don't have access to that, then you know, it might not be such a good deal. Yeah?
Since EndNote incorporates into Word, whatever program you're running, I use it quite extensively when I write, and I've noticed sometimes whenever I'm doing a Word document that does not include any EndNote at all, I don't know, maybe it's buggy or something, but you know, 30 windows will pop up saying EndNote error or something like that.
Yes.
Is that something that we can fix? Or?
I've never gotten EndNote errors, but I'll often, like if I drag a picture into a document that doesn't have any EndNote, sometimes it'll bring up like the page settings. And so yes, I think, EndNote's not perfect software. My first thing would be to recommend uninstalling it entirely and then getting the newest version from the library. Because I do find that happens more frequently, like if I'm running an older version of EndNote with a new version of Office. And so that's why it's nice to have access to the updates. But unfortunately, I think there's always going to be some of that. And in those cases, the best advice is just to save your work regularly, so that when Word crashes, you know, you always have a good copy that you can go back to. Okay. Well, if there's no other questions, I think that's it.